Blog Talk Radio.
In the desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. Well, the cross in the desert, an appropriate title for today. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. And as I was saying, part of my title for the program, The Cross in the Desert, is appropriate where I live today. We have an oppressive heat wave here. 104 degrees is the expected high today. And yours truly, part of his job is working outside. So, how hot is it in Florissant today? It is so hot that the ice in your cup melts, and then the cup melts. And it is so hot. Well, how hot is it, Randy? It is so hot that the chickens are laying boiled eggs. Believe me, it is going to be a scorcher today. Well, welcome to The Cross in the Desert, where today I'm, of course, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. Today I want to center in on the Trump administration recertifying the Iran deal. This is an important topic that I want to talk a little bit at length with you today about. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump had viciously attacked the Obama administration's Iran deal as being a bad deal that he wants to rip up. And he hasn't changed his mind on wanting to rip up the deal. But as president, there are other voices in his administration, Mattis, Tillerson, and others that don't agree that that is the right approach to take. Now, understand the context here. We are facing nuclear foes in the people of Iran, the government of Iran, and, of course, North Korea. These two countries in particular present a real threat to our liberties, Iran and North Korea. And I believe without a doubt that President Trump is far better at foreign policy than Obama ever could even dream of. And so why the recertification of the Iran deal? What is going on there? He attacked this deal viciously on his campaign trail. Well, in the interests of your allies, and unfortunately there are others in the European Union that have fixed economic ties to Iran, but this is what the Trump administration said when they decided to recertify the deal. They have to visit this situation every 90 days. On paper, Tehran has complied with the terms of the deal, but they have violated the spirit of the agreement. So I want to do something to help you understand this. I want to read some copy related to this whole situation. Then I'm going to play a soundbite from Security Advisor Sebastian Gorka. The decision on Monday also had more vows to enforce the deal in the future, but with imposing new sanctions on Iran, particularly for its violations of the ballistic missile work and, of course, their support for proxy forces in the Middle East. And, of course, I'm referring to Syria. Iran is unquestionably in default of the spirit of the deal, one of the senior Trump administration's officials said. As they have in the past, Trump administration officials decried the international agreement, which has the broad support of Washington's key European allies, for not resolving grievances with Tehran outside the nuclear issue, such as human rights. So what that says in essence is the Trump administration is committed to dealing not just with the nuclear framework, but putting pressure on Iran for its human rights. I'm really happy to hear that. As far as my Iranian friends go, we're going to be working with our allies to explore options of addressing the flaws of this deal, the official said. The Trump administration's plan to keep the deal in place nearly derailed earlier on Tuesday after the Oval Office grappled with an op-ed by former U.S. Ambassador to the UN John Bolton calling for Trump to withdraw from the deal. Such a move was reportedly opposed by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster's. Trump and other political aides have been wary of their right flank when it comes to the Iran issue. The Trump administration issued tough talking points on Monday, promising that it will confront Iran and its proxies throughout the Middle East. The behind-the-scenes PR campaign demonstrates the White House sensitivity to criticism from right-wing hawks who believe the Trump administration should have immediately pulled out of the nuclear deal. And this was, of course, President Trump's promise during the presidential campaign. Now, the talking points said that the Treasury Department would impose sanctions on 7 Iranian government entities and 5 individuals in an effort to show determination to punish Iran for its called malign activities that make Iran one of the most dangerous threats to U.S. interests. Those activities include continued work, which Iran has been doing on developing ballistic missiles, support for terrorism and militancy, complicity with the government of President Bashar al-Assad in Syria, hostility to Israel, and cyber attacks on the U.S., Israel, and U.S. allies in the Gulf. So these are the reasons for new imposed sanctions. Now, what are the key themes and the messages about Iran through this deal that we need to recognize? Well, number one, Iran remains one of the most dangerous threats to U.S. interests and to regional stability. The full range of Iran's malign activities extends well beyond the nuclear threat and includes, number one, ballistic missiles development and proliferation, support to terrorism and militancy, complicity in the Assad regime's atrocities against the Syrian people, unrelenting hostility to Israel, consistently threatening freedom of navigation, and you know this, where our own Navy men last year, in fact, were seized in the Persian Gulf area. Now, they continue their cyber attacks against the U.S., Israel, and America's allies and partners in the region. Grievous human rights abuses, and I could go on and on about that subject. I know a lot about that. arbitrary detention of foreigners, including U.S. citizens, on specious charges and without due process. So this is the Iran violation of the spirit of the deal. They continue to fall down and oppose themselves to the spirit of the agreement. Now, the previous administration ignored, excused, and downplayed the full range of Iran's behavior. The Trump administration is going to address the full behavior of the Iran regime, not just the nuclear things. And that was a huge mistake that the Obama administration did. They downplayed the totality of Iran's problems. Now, what I want to do right now, I want to play a soundbite from security advisor Sebastian Gorka with Bill Hemmer on Fox News just a couple of days ago as this recertification of the Iran deal was made public. I want you to hear this right now on The Cross in the Desert.
As these two sides, the Iran issue is back in the headlines, and as we talk about that now, we know the Trump team had big disagreements with the Obama team previously in its position. Sebastian Gorka is with me live now from the North Lawn, representing the administration. Sir, and thank you for coming back here, and good morning.
Good morning to you.
Let's go ahead and figure out why recertify when there's a clear indication on behalf of the administration that Iran is up to things that you don't like.
Great question. The best analogy is, imagine if, Bill, you buy a used car, and the used car came with a warranty, but it was a really bad warranty. You're stuck with the car. It doesn't mean you're going to break the warranty, but it doesn't mean that that car isn't a lemon. So look what happened yesterday. We were very clear. We gave a statement on 16 additional individuals and organizations that are going to be sanctioned by the United States. Why? Because Iran is not in compliance with the spirit of this agreement. The agreement was predicated on it producing regional stability and global security. It does none of that. So it's a bad deal, technically alone. They are in compliance with the aspects of the bad deal as we inherited it, but when it comes to the overall spirit and the intent, it remains what the president has always called it, a bad deal for America.
However, doctor, you could have said your position at the moment is that we are not in a position to recertify. Why not?
Yeah, because they were in terms of the technical requirements. Unfortunately, because it's such a weak agreement, they were in. We can't insert new requirements into an agreement that was a multi-nation agreement, right? So we can say they're doing things with ballistic missiles, fast boats, terror financing, but unfortunately, the Obama administration left all of this out. That's the weakness of this deal. It treats Iran as only important based upon one thing, nuclear weapons, which is incredibly important, but it ignored everything else.
The Obama administration, you know what the campaign pledge was, right? It was rip it up. So how does this White House address that comment now?
By exactly what we're doing right now. We are not committed to any more recertifications of this deal in the future. It's up to us. And the most important thing, Bill, the most important thing is right now as we speak, my colleagues in the NSC just over there, my colleagues in the West Wing, they are continuing the comprehensive review of Iran strategy by this nation, and also of the JCPOA deal. We had a time limit. We had to submit.
JCP stands for, again?
The Iran deal.
Okay.
The JCPOA is the Iran deal. So we're doing a comprehensive review, which could lead to all kinds of decisions. In the meantime, we had this deadline for Congress. We said they're not in compliance with the spirit of the agreement. Technically they are, but that's irrelevant. Therefore, because of all the contraventions of other things that endanger us and our allies and partners, we're going to slap these new sanctions on top of them. I think that sends a pretty strong message to Tehran.
You wonder if that will change behavior, and that remains to be seen.
We shall see.
Take you back 24 hours. It's a report that the president was not going to do this.
We had a very long discussion.
That was hung in the balance.
I was in the Oval.
Okay,
give our viewers
a sense, doctor. What did the president say about the recertification, and why in the end did it happen?
Oh, exactly what we've published already in the last 12 hours. The president maintains his stance. This is a bad deal for America and for our allies and our partners. Nothing's changed. This is a thing. This is a technical requirement on a bad deal we inherited that we didn't close. Remember, this is the Obama regime's
deal. Yeah,
I get it.
Did Rex Tillerson talk the president out of that decision?
We were in a conversation together. It was the president, myself, various principals. We don't talk about the internal mechanics. But we had a very, very robust discussion, and the president maintains his stance on the campaign.
Last question, and then we're going to go to the vice president and Pence talking about health care. Is this decision now in the hands of the State Department, or is President Trump still in full control as to whether or not you certify the next time around or not?
Oh, absolutely. It's the president's call. The president is the commander-in-chief.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your time today.
Bill Hemmer, Sebastian Gorka, security advisor to the president, discussing this bad deal. And, of course, they inherited this deal from the Obama administration. This was with other nations. And so you cannot insert new requirements in this deal because it was voted on by many other nations. That would be going against the contract, if you will. And so President Trump still categorizes this as a horribly bad deal. And the bottom line is that Tehran met the technical requirements, but they have violated the spirit of the agreement since the very beginning. They cannot be trusted. They are supporters of Hezbollah. They are supporters of terrorists. They use the ransom money for terrorism. You remember that? December 2015 or January 2016 when Americans were finally released from prisons. It was a day none of us will forget because Saeed Abedini, an American pastor, was released, Amir Hikmati. We found out later that this was a ransom deal with real cash money. How much other things were given to Iran? The billions of dollars in sanction relief money and then a ransom paid for American hostages. This is what the Obama administration did, completely caved to Tehran, our enemy. The Iranian government is our enemy. I want to take us back about a year and a half ago, and I want to highlight just how ridiculous, how despicable, how betraying the Obama administration was to the Iranian regime. I want you to hear this soundbite. It's a historical soundbite of what was already paid to Iran over a year and a half ago. Let's listen.
Was the Obama administration's $400 million cash payout to Iran legal?
If you like your hostage, you keep your hostage. The slug line of the single-payer ransom program.
$400 million in cash, euros and Swiss francs, on an unmarked cargo plane.
The reason it was concealed is because it's illegal. That's why.
Brian, I'm asking you what you and the secretary think about this delivery
of
cash.
She was out of office by the time this happened.
The standard Clinton technique.
The money is in cash. Why in cash? Because that way you can't trace it. It's going to go straight to Hezbollah.
Justice Department officials objected to sending a plane loaded with cash to Tehran. Their objections were overruled by the State Department.
The Justice Department raised objections.
Of course the Justice Department objected. It was illegal.
30 years ago, this would have been something that would have launched congressional hearings. We would have had convictions. We would have had indictments.
The regime laundered $400 million.
If a private company had done this, this is called money laundering. The CEO would be in jail right now.
Illinois Congressman Peter Roskin goes on the record. Good evening, sir.
Greta, good to be with you. Thanks.
Is this transaction, this $400,000 cash transaction, which incidentally people knew about in January, but it's getting more publicity now, is this illegal, number one? And if it is, what are you going to do about it?
Look, I think it is illegal. It's $400 million, and the administration is trying to just whitewash this, saying, oh, everybody knew about it. No, nobody knew about it. And this is now clearly contemporaneous. That is, cash for hostages. And what it is an illustration of is just this desperate desire on the part of the Obama administration to come up with some foreign policy legacy around the Iran deal. And there's nothing, and I'll repeat this, there is nothing that the Iranians can do that the Obama administration would walk away from. And now they're defending this. They've been complicit in transferring cash for hostages. Period, paragraph, end of letter.
I think that's fair to say. I went back and did some research that it was in the there were reports about it last January, but I think, you know, the media, I think, fell down on this one. And it's great happiness to see Americans come home. They didn't pay that much attention. I think what's new now is the fact that it does look like a ransom. I mean, even the administration is saying that the Iranians want something of substance or something. So obviously it was a ransom. But is there anything you can do about that? It violates American policy.
Well,
but what can you do?
Look, what you do is you talk about it, you bring attention to it, you make it clear that what was happening was this exact thing that people warned about. Congressman Mike Pompeo from Kansas, Congressman Ed Royce from California wrote to the administration, congressional letters of inquiry, tell us about these deals. So now what's happened since then, Greta, is two more Americans have been held hostage. And now is there going to be another exchange? And of course there will be, just based on this general approach of things. And I think now the question the public has to ask and that has to be answered is this the type of foreign policy that we can be proud of? Is this the type of foreign policy that means America is strong and being ascendant? No, it's a very de minimis foreign policy, and it's pathetic, and it's underperforming, and it feeds into a narrative of American weakness and the ascendancy of our opponents, particularly ISIL and others around the world. It's part of a terrible, terrible foreshadowing of things to come if this continues.
There are two other issues. One is that it was in cash, and the other that it was not in American dollars. Now, President Obama says it wasn't in American dollars because we had no banking relationship, but why was this in cash?
Look, it's in cash so that they could hustle it. It's in cash so that it would be unmarked. It's in cash so that it is untraceable. And the notion that we've got to somehow give a payment to the Iranians so that it is convenient for the Iranians only illustrates how desperate the Iranians, the Obama administration is for an Iranian deal. There's nothing
that Iran can do that they wouldn't
support at this point. It's pathetic.
That proves to me that it's a ransom and not just a coincidence, the fact that the Iranians needed something. Anyway, Congressman, thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Greta.
Yes. Unbelievable. So-called Obama a legacy. He wants to leave this glorious, grand legacy. He certainly has left a legacy, a complete mess in foreign policy, condescending and appeasing a terrorist regime. That is the legacy of the Obama administration. The Trump administration is not going to follow in those footsteps. Donald Trump is going to be tough on Iran. He's going to address the totality of their behavior, including human rights. I'm very excited about this because that's what I do my program for, to speak out and bring awareness to this massive human rights violations of the Iranians. I want to read to you now a story that my good friend Paymaneh Sabet, who's an Iranian Christian refugee in Malaysia, wrote. We have decided together to focus on refugees on my program as much and as often as possible. And she has been busy collecting stories of Iranian refugees all over the world and presenting them to me. Now, this is a recent story. Since we're talking about the Iran deal, we're talking about the massive violation of human rights and the reasons why Iranians become refugees to get away from an oppressive government that is destroying their lives. This is one example. And let me just say something up front before I read this. Every Iranian refugee that I talk to, it breaks their heart to have to leave their own homeland in order to find freedom. And of course, all of that changed in February of 1979 after the Shah went into exile and Khomeini returned from exile in Paris and became the Islamic leader, the Ayatollah. And the entire history of Iran was changed on February 1st, 1979. Iranians have had to leave their own country because of the oppression of the government. There's nothing but beauty in history in Iran, and it's a wonderful place, but it was tarred tarnished by Islam in the 7th century, and human rights began to be devalued then through an Islamic invasion. And of course, under the Shah, Iran became a secular Western power, and the mullahs hated that, and that's why they rose up and installed Khomeini as their new leader. That's a long history, but it happened. Iranians have had to leave their country to seek asylum in other countries in order to have freedom. Now, I want to read to you the story of one of these people that my friend Paymanig talked to, and I want to read his story as an Iranian refugee. He says a few months ago, or I should say, Paymanig says, a few months ago, a Kurdish man contacted me through Facebook and asked me to introduce him to my friends in Sweden to get some emotional help. The sentences he wrote showed he was very lonely, depressed, and two repeated saying, "I'm very depressed." What happened to him in Iran made him avoid people around him and rely on people online. Now, this is from the chats that Paymanig has had with this Iranian refugee. He says, "I'm a Kurd and a Sunni Iranian. One of our crimes in the eyes of the Islamic regime in Iran is that our race, the Kurdish race, is inferior. Like any other people, we do not have control over our own race, and we cannot select the family we're born into. Yet, the Islamic regime kills us. Just for that, they condemn us and accuse us all the time. Some of us are killed, quote, as drug dealers, some for doing terrorist attacks by gun, and some for bank robbery and many other crimes that we're not even aware of. I was supposed to be a victim of this government, but I could escape from Iran even though it was very risky. I took all of that risk to travel to Sweden. I arrived in Sweden over 1 year ago. Some of the refugees say that my situation really isn't that bad. I have a camp to live in. I get meals and some money per month, but it is not easy to survive. I'm staying in this place. I don't want to have to leave my homeland. Stress is killing me. I haven't been called for an interview by the immigration board yet. There is nothing to do, and there is no difference between days and nights. All the time, I'm gazing at the sky from the roof. At the age of 42, I don't have a perspective of the future. The nightmare of always being deported back to Iran is always with me. When I see someone rejected, I lose all my hope, and I just want to die. The death from which I escaped. Kurdish men are supposed to be strong and hardworking. I cannot stand being jobless, doing nothing here in Sweden. And when there is nothing to do, only thinking, thinking ends in desperation and frustration. I don't know how many more days or weeks or months I will have to wait for an interview. And after that, how long will I have to wait for the results? And I don't even know what the results will be. If good, am I in a good enough emotional condition to leave? Do I have enough energy to shout for joy if I'm accepted? All these years, I studied hard to guarantee my good future, but here is my future. Instead of having my own job and controlling my own life and supporting others, I have occupied a foreign country here in Sweden, and they are forced to support me and control my life. And they're nice enough to do that. My family has not even seen their son for over a year. I can't do anything for them. I just wait here day and night, filled with stress. I'm sure my mother cries every day since she has witnessed many other mothers have lost their sons, or many other mothers have lost their sons in prison. What I feel here is that asylum seekers from some other countries are given more priorities than Iranians for immigration. Some believe that our country, Iran, is peaceful. Is it really peaceful? Does hanging people in silence mean peace? Letting people die in prisons for years and years, depriving them of medical and treatment and food, is that peaceful? Torturing people to death in prison due to their race, religion, and political stance, is that peaceful? Forcing educated people to flee their own country to save their lives, is that peaceful? If our country is peaceful, why should educated people who have home and jobs suddenly have to leave their homes and put their children in danger and travel to Australia on a boat? If my country is peaceful, why are cemeteries full of graves of young people who were either executed in prison or killed in the streets, are dropped off of balconies in planned incidents? If my country is peaceful, why are all those hardworking, genius, intelligent people, why are they in prison? If my country is peaceful, why am I a Kurdish man, a proud Kurdish man, find myself hiding from others, not to see my tears and strong shoulders? If my country is peaceful, why am I a refugee? Thank you so much, Peymaneh. This man does not choose to be named, but he is illustrating the hard life of a refugee. And just a few months ago, I published my newest book, Finding Hope in a Future, Maral's Journey to Freedom. Maral was once a refugee who had to flee Iran, and I wrote her story of how she landed safely in Germany and today is working hard at learning the language, assimilating, and becoming a very powerfully strong, productive German citizen. And she would tell you, just like this Iranian would tell you living in Sweden, that she didn't want to have to leave her family in her homeland, but it was either that or face prison and torture. Very, very sad, very, very seriously sad situation. Since we're talking about Iran today and human rights and the Iran deal, I want to focus right now on the plight of Iranian women and what they have to go through on a daily basis. In my book, The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran, which was published about a year and a half ago, I wrote the story of my good friend Atifi, who lives in Tehran. I asked her for my book signing that I did at the bookstores when I shared my books about my Iranian friends. I asked her to write what life was like daily for the Iranian woman. And she wrote something very powerful. And I entitled it in my book, A Day in the Life of an Iranian Woman. I want you to hear this. She says, Atifi writes, imagine a day when you wake up and dress as normal as you always do. You are fresh to start a day. But as you reach your university facility, your phone rings. It's the security guard. They have been watching you talk to male classmates. So you were called to the discipline committee to prove that you aren't involved with that boy, which is in violation of the Islamic rules. You can never prove that, and you get something like a note in your graduation certificate stating that you had an illegitimate relationship with your classmate. Another day, as you enter the university facility, a woman wearing a chador stops you at the door and asks, what's that makeup you're wearing? Again, discipline committee. Day three, your mobile rings. It's the discipline committee. Miss, why have you got a Facebook account? Why aren't you wearing a hijab in your profile picture? Again, discipline committee. Have you got a boyfriend? Who are your friends? Do your friends have boyfriends? Do they have sex with their boyfriends? Do your friends stay at your boyfriend's house? Then they ask you to spy for them in the dorm and report to them anything that happens there. If you say anything against Islam or any of the political figures, your parents will never see you ever again. You have graduated now and you are working. 8 a.m. You go out of the house, and when you reach downtown, the Gashtir Shad, that is the morality police, stops you. Again, the same questions. They take you to a police station. You sit next to men who have been arrested in the street. They take a picture of you holding a paper with your name on it, exactly like a criminal. They treat you like a prostitute, bombarding you with their words and accusations, until you burst into tears. Then they call your house and ask your parents to bring a longer manteau, and that is a dress that Iranian women wear that covers all of their skin and that no skin is showing. And then you have to sign a commitment paper which says that if you're on the street and they don't like your appearance, you will have to appear in court, and the vicious cycle continues for the rest of your life. They now even stop your car to check your appearance. These are the daily routines for Iranian girls. And when you wish to free yourself by migrating somewhere else, the sanctions and poor economic conditions won't allow you to pay the primary expenses. Then you feel there is nothing called God or no justice. You can't even imagine the way we live here. You can't even imagine. No, you never can. This is my friend Adafi talking basically about the rules of Islam for dress, for appearance, that you're going to get in trouble if you have a Facebook account, because Facebook is banned in Iran, and the only way Iranians get online through Facebook is through anti-filter or VPN, and that itself is against the Islamic rules. But the president and the supreme leader, they both have Facebook accounts. How hypocritical. But she's also talking about the morality police that confronts women in the street. If your hijab is not on, covering skin, if it's showing too much skin, if you have on makeup or polished fingernails, you can be arrested. You can be fined. You can even be publicly lashed. And so this vicious cycle for Iranian women continues all the time. And I wanted to share that from my book. The good news for Iranians is there is a God in heaven who cares. When Jesus was here on earth in his public ministry, he did something about the oppression of women. He elevated the status of women. He attacked the very society, and the religious leaders oppressed women, just like they're oppressed in Iran. And do you know, many Muslim women are finding their hope and peace in Jesus. And one of the things that attracts them so much to the gospel is when they hear about or read about the way Jesus treated women. I want to play you one of my favorite interviews with an Iranian woman named Samira. I've played this before. It's such a powerful, powerful story of how Samira, living in Iran, left Islam specifically when she found out how Jesus treated women. I want you to hear her short testimony. Let's listen right now on the cross in the desert.
It was 1979, the year that a million protesters flooded the streets when the Ayatollah Khomeini overthrew the Shah of Iran. He established Islamic law for all citizens. Samira was just a young girl when this happened.
In the beginning, I had a very fun childhood. When I was born, it was during the Shah's time, and soon after was the Islamic Revolution.
Samira's family didn't practice Islam, though, so she rebelled against the strict laws.
We started having clothes restrictions. We couldn't wear certain clothes anymore. Then we had to wear overcoats and jeans and scarves. Then there was color restrictions. We only had to wear dark colors like black, gray, dark navy, brown. And you can imagine it gets very hot in the summer in Iran, and so it was very difficult.
She especially hated the laws that didn't treat boys and girls as equals.
You would go to a swimming pool, the boys could go swimming, but the girls couldn't, because if the government police came by and saw girls in the swimming pool, parents and families would be arrested and taken to jail. Little by little, I felt as a little girl, they took the life out of me. Where what used to be fun, going to school used to be fun, playing with my friends used to be fun, all of that changed.
One day, Samira experienced the injustice of being treated as a second-class citizen. Her hair had come out of her head covering, and a female police officer stepped in.
She grabbed me. She starts shaking me. What are you doing? You have hair showing. And she started, going on and on about how what I'm doing is a sin and what I'm doing is completely inappropriate, and I kind of kicked her as a little kid and ran away so I don't get arrested. As a little kid, I was afraid of being arrested or being thrown in jail because I had some hair showing. But it was very traumatizing for me as a little girl.
She began to associate the strict Islamic laws with God himself.
I remember thinking, if this is God, I want no part of him. Because if God exists, he is just and he's going to be fair. He's not going to make a big difference between a man and a woman.
Her views were challenged, though, when her family moved to the United States. Her younger sister became a Christian, and it wasn't her new religion that Samira noticed. It was the change in her heart.
She became a different person, and when I looked into her eyes, I remember thinking, wow, what a dramatic difference. I thought I was seeing angels. And it was through that that I saw power of Christ, and I thought, maybe God exists.
She decided to find out what made such a difference in her sister's life and talked to her pastor.
He came to talk to me, and we sat down, and he shared the Bible with me and the story of Christ and salvation.
She still had questions in her mind, but what she heard one day on a Christian radio program made it all clear.
The radio station was talking about a lady who had tried to do good, who tried to help people, but at the end of the day, she didn't know where she was going because she didn't have God in her life. I thought, when it's time for me to go, I don't know where I'm going.
Samira prayed with the man on the radio.
I went through the prayer with him, the salvation prayer, not realizing what I had done, and I accepted Christ into my heart.
She's amazed at the freedom women have in Christ.
And so when you see Jesus, and how he talks about women in the Bible and how he values women, I just think that just all helped me realize that how God is just and love, no matter what time in history we're talking about.
Today, Samira actively works in the legal system, helping women in the United States escape from the harsh rules of the Islamic lifestyle.
I thank God for the fact that I'm here in the United States. I thank God for the freedom that I have.
Samira knows firsthand that true freedom comes only through Jesus Christ.
We've seen a lot of societies how women are put down, women are treated badly, all because of who they are and what they come from. But when it comes to Jesus, all of that goes away, and we have all the same rights. We all have the same amount of love that we get from God, which is a lot, and we're all one. There's no difference, and I think that's the beauty of Jesus.
I never tire of playing this interview, this testimony. It is one of the most powerful ones on YouTube. This is an Iranian woman whose life was changed by Christ in a most dramatic way, especially when she saw how he valued women. And she compared that with the Islamic Republic of Iran and how they devalued and how they treated women as second-class citizens. This is really important. This is what is awakening the Muslim world. It is the power of Christ in the gospel, and it is the power of Christ in how he treated women and valued women. I want to talk to you a little bit about Jesus and the role of women. I found this tremendous article from Jews for Jesus. It was written a long time ago, but it really speaks to the issue of Jesus and the role of women. You know, Jesus was a revolutionary. His actions elicited surprising reactions from his contemporaries in all facets of life. He was not afraid to challenge the status quo and reestablish scriptural precedents. But without a knowledge of the rabbinic attitudes that prevailed in Jesus' day, that uniqueness of our Lord's behavior would escape us. Take, for example, Jesus' dealings with women. By publicly including women in his ministry, Jesus shattered the prejudicial customs of his day. Why was it unusual for Jesus to speak with women? Nothing in the Mosaic law prevented men and women from conversing with one another. Yet, the society of Jesus' day, with custom dictated by rabbinic Judaism, differed strikingly from the Old Testament social order. So let's look back now at how women were treated in the Old Testament. The social condition of women in the first century had been radically altered from their Old Testament sisters. In earlier times, women participated in every aspect of community life except the temple priesthood. Women freely engaged in commerce and real estate, as well as in manual labor. They were not excluded from temple worship. Women played music in the sanctuary. They prayed there. They sang. They danced with men in religious processions and participated in music and festivities at weddings. Women were included when God instituted the Mosaic Covenant, which is found in Deuteronomy 29:11, and were present when Joshua read the Torah to Israel. Their presence was not just an option. They were required to be present for the public reading of the scriptures, especially on the Feast of Tabernacles, Deuteronomy 31:12. Nor were women limited to private roles in the Old Testament. Several exercised leadership roles over Israel. Miriam led the women of Israel in worship. Deborah was a judge and a prophetess. And Huldah also was a prophetess whom King Josiah consulted instead of Jeremiah, her contemporary. Women were held in high regard. In Old Testament times, in Genesis 21:12, we read that God told Abraham to listen to his wife. Proverbs 18:22 tells us that he who finds a wife finds a good thing. And Proverbs 19:14 says that an intelligent wife is a gift from God. Wise women are also found their way into the pages of the Bible. Abigail's wisdom and valor so touched King David that she became his wife. And the wise woman of Tekoa was sent to persuade David to lift the ban on his son Absalom. Now that was all examples in the Old Testament. However, by New Testament times, women's rights had certainly declined. By the time of Christ, the role of women had drastically changed for the worse. In theory, women were held in high regard by first century Jewish society, but in practice, that was not always true. The concept of tezniya, or the private role of the woman, was based on Psalm 45:13. The king's daughter is all glorious within. While a man's primary responsibility was seen as public, a woman's life was confined almost entirely private family sphere. Women were not allowed to testify in court. In effect, this categorized them with Gentiles, minors, deaf mutes, and undesirables, such as gamblers, the insane, usurers, and pigeon racers, who were also denied that privilege. Customarily, even a woman of stature could not engage in commerce and would rarely be seen outside of her home. Only a woman in dire economic straits who was forced to become the family breadwinner could engage in her own small trade. If a woman was ever in the streets, she was to be heavily veiled and was prohibited from conversing with men. It is the way of a woman to stay at home, and it is the way of a man to go out in the workplace, according to Bereshit Rabbah in Tanat 23b. In Talmudic times, respectable women were expected to stay within the confines of the home. The terminology for a prostitute was, quote, one who goes abroad. The woman of the first century did not even do her own shopping, except possibly just to go out, accompanied by a slave, to buy material which she would use to construct her own clothing at home. The women with whom Jesus spoke were probably very illiterate, since the rabbis did not consider it incumbent upon women to learn to read in order to study the scriptures. Now, women were separated from men in private, public, and religious life. They could go to the temple, but did not venture beyond the confine of the woman's court. Women were not allowed to participate in public prayer at the temple, although they were encouraged to have private prayer lives at home. The few rights of a woman included her to go to the house of study to hear a sermon or pray. Also was her basic right to attend a wedding feast or a house of mourning or to visit her relatives. Now, one Talmudic passage best sums up the situation of women at the time of Christ. They are swathed like a mourner, referring to their face and hair coverings, isolated from people and shut up in prison. What brought about the drastic change? What happened? Change everything. Jesus. Jesus shattered this darkness by offering his teachings freely to anyone who would listen, whether they were women or men. We see him directly talking with women on numerous occasions. The woman at the well is perhaps the best known of these. We sense the astounded reaction of the disciples that their teacher should be seen talking with a woman. They marveled that he talked with the woman. Yet no man said, "What seekest thou?" or "Why talkest thou with her?" In Luke's gospel, we see Jesus publicly associating with women. Some were women of high standing in society, and some were women of ill repute, and some even had been possessed by demons. One of these, Mary Magdalene, who in great thankfulness was with him until the moment he died, was the first person to whom he appeared to after his resurrection. We look in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 15, verses 22 through 28. Jesus spoke with a Canaanite woman. The disciples urged him, "Send her on her way, for it was improper for a teacher to speak with a woman, and a foreign one at that." At first, Jesus did not answer her plea for help, but as she prevailed upon him with great need and even great faith, he had mercy on her and granted her request. Time after time in the Gospels, we see Jesus offering his teachings, healing, and forgiveness to women as well as men. Often it was the women who were the most appreciative of his ministry. Indeed, we see the first proclaimer of Jesus to the Jewish people was a woman, Anna, in the temple. A woman washed Jesus' feet in Luke chapter 7 and anointed him for his burial in Mark chapter 14. It was women who were with him at the cross until the end, and women who were the first to come to the tomb and proclaim his resurrection. And we see the New Testament followers continue to follow in his footsteps and counting them as laborers for Christ. So we see that because of him, Jesus, all individuals, Jew or Greek, or slave or free, male or female, all are considered one in Christ and enjoy unqualified freedom as children of God. The Gospels are the stories of how Jesus lifted women out of the gutter as second-class citizens. Perhaps the best example of this is the woman caught in adultery, where she is considered by the religious establishment as a wanton woman that should be stoned. Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her, "What do you say, Jesus?" The scribes and the Pharisees are convinced. They have cornered Jesus, and he has no way out of this situation. If Jesus agrees to stone this adulterous woman, then his reputation of being compassionate and a friend of sinners, well, that's going to be all called into question. If, however, Jesus says to spare her, then he is contradicting the law of Moses, and he's going to be exposed as a false prophet. Well, what does Jesus do with the woman caught in adultery? Well, it's an incredible display of compassion and wisdom. Jesus kneels down and writes in the dust with his finger. Then he gazes intently into their eyes with this masterful answer. "Let the one who has never sinned throw the first stone." I can picture the utter shock and conviction on the faces of these religious leaders. They never expected an answer like that. Jesus has pointed his finger at the greater sin in this situation, the hypocrisy of the religious leaders. They weren't interested in upholding the law of God, but rather using the sin of this woman to further their crusades of lies and deceits against Jesus. The statement of Jesus silenced their accusations. One by one, they dropped their stones and departed. Well, the question is, was Jesus being soft on the law of God? No, absolutely not. He turns to the woman and asks, "Where are your accusers? Does no one accuse you?" The woman answers meekly, "No, Lord." Jesus spoke and looks with compassion in her eyes and says, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." This story in the Gospel of John beautifully illustrates the mercy and grace of Jesus. He affirms she has broken God's law, yet instead of agreeing to the execution, Jesus covers her sin with his mercy and compassion. And this is precisely what Jesus did for us at the cross. He willingly took the wrath of God in our place so that we could be spared and forgiven. I believe Jesus would utter these same words to the religious leaders of Iran. He would not tolerate the unjust and cruel punishment and discrimination of women in Iran. He would expose their religious hypocrisy. There is only one who is sinless and has the right to cast the first stone. And that, of course, is Jesus. We need to remember that. Mercy triumphs over justice and judgment. Mercy. This is who Jesus is. This is why Muslim women are leaving Islam every day and embracing Christ. They see in Jesus a man of absolute love and compassion. He is unconditional love and mercy. He is holy and righteous, yet mercy is his middle name. It's who Jesus is. And what he does for the situation of women speaks to the heart of Muslim women everywhere. Jesus has appeared in dreams and visions to Muslims all over the world, to these Muslim women who are oppressed and in fear all of their life for not living up to the standards of Allah. And they find in Christ someone who loves them for who they are, and who cares for them right where they're at. And they are willing to leave the darkness of Islam and embrace the beauty and the love of Jesus. Does that describe you today? If it does, Jesus is calling you. And all you have to do to respond is come to him in simple childlike faith and bow before him, and you admit that you've broken God's law, that you're guilty of sin like all of us. All of us have sinned, and we constantly fall short of the glory of God. And Jesus embraces us. He forgives us completely. He washes away all of our guilt and shame, and we're changed, and we become sons and daughters of God. Jesus wants to call you daughter of God today when you come to him in simple childlike faith. I want you to think about this when you listen to the song I'm going to play for our broadcast today. It's by Chris Tomlin. It's called Jesus. I hope you've enjoyed this teaching today. I hope that you come to know Christ as your Lord and Savior. I will see you again on Monday on the cross in the desert.
There is a truth older than the ages. There is a promise.